My name is Bill Cavanaugh.
Hi, Bill.
I am an adult child. I will continue to qualify. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the 21st of September, 1986. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon since 1993, when my first wife decided it was fun to start drinking. I have been doing ACA work. I'll explain that in just a second. And I have, over the last 2 years, I have been incredibly blessed and privileged to be a co-sponsor for two Alateen groups. And just absolutely amazed the things I am learning from these children. So having said all of that, I picked back in August of last year when it came out, they were looking for speakers. I sent in an idea of what would it be, you know, recovery around the dinner table. And because we'd been banging that around in Connecticut at the intergroup level, and nobody seems to want to pick up the ball, so we kept fooling around with it. So here it is. I get to try it out on the West Coast where nobody knows me. So, first thing I would like to do, though, because it is after dinner, and those of you that are not, you can finish. But I'd like to make a little circle around this table with the people who are willing to do this exercise. So that would be you four and you guys. You don't have to. Those who are willing, you need to stand. Please stand. Okay? And then I'll explain the rules, because there's just a couple of quick rules. Okay, give yourself some room. Okay, kind of equidistant. There we go. Now, yep. You must look at someone else, but you cannot be looking at each other. No eye contact. So you can look at someone else, but no eye contact. Okay, wait, I'll tell you the next thing. You must mimic whatever the other person is doing that you're watching. That, hang on, slow down. We're going to start.
Can we look at different people?
Nope. Person? Pick one person, stay on that person, and just focus on that person. Now, what's going to happen is everybody's going to do something. And then we'll see what happens. You have 60 seconds. Okay, you ready? Go. Okay, stop. Now, look around. We all ended up at attention, but did you, out that weren't involved with it, did you notice what was happening? Everyone was doing the exact same thing. Interesting, isn't it? Now, if we were going to do this again, it wouldn't work because we would all try and overthink it. Okay, so it's really good when you have about 60 people and then you time it and then bang, about 60 seconds. Okay, and I'll bring that up. I'm going to use that example here in just a second. That exercise is just a quick little exercise in nonverbal imitation. Okay? Nonverbal. You guys weren't talking. So, growing up in my family, let me tell you a little bit about my family. I'll tell you a little bit about me. I'm the second son of five children to an Irish Catholic. I am William Francis, son of Walter Thomas, son of Thomas Francis, son of Thomas Francis, son of Michael Francis, who came over in 1854 as an 18-year-old Irish day laborer. Now, those of you that might remember a little bit about history, 1854 is really close to what for 18-year-old Irish day laborers? The Civil War. Okay? So Margaret, Michael's wife, came over in 1856, and they got married. They had 11 children. Okay, pretty quick, because you see what's going on here. We got a war, so it's probably about Irish. Everybody know what Irish twins are?
Yeah. No?
Never heard of Irish twins? Yeah, well, there was a lot of them in this family, because 11 survived. Okay, 11 survived. One of those is my lineage, Thomas, who begat Thomas, who begat Walter, who begat me, who begat Matthew Francis, and then my grandson, Quinn Liam. So, nothing about Irish. All of those things going on at the dinner table, the traditions, the traditions, how we dealt at the dinner table, came down that long line. You know, when the big book calls it that bundle of sticks. Along the line, there was tragedies. Those tragedies, using today's terminology, traumas, affected how things happened at the dinner table. For example, my grandfather Walter, or my dad's Walter, my grandfather Thomas, died when my father was 7 years old. My dad was born in 1929. Okay, what's going on in 1929? The Depression, you know? Now, my grandfather had the audacity in 19 to marry an Episcopalian, okay, and brought an Episcopalian into a nice Irish Catholic community. She converted, of course, but she was never one of us. So here we have George, Margaret, Walter, and Florence. And they're on their way to 11, but then he dies. Now, my grandfather was about this tall, and he had about 60 pounds on me. Okay, so I don't know what that was all about. Probably had a lot to do with alcohol. Okay. So my father grew up in a very matriarchal family, with no, and his older brother George went off to serve the country, just like your dad, in the Pacific. Spent 3.5 years in the Pacific. So dad was the only male in that whole society or in that family unit that was growing up, and while she was converted, they were never really accepted. So dad grew up in that family. He never knew how, this is how things I've learned, he never knew how to be a father. He didn't have a father. Dad was seven little guy. Okay? So what he learned from my grandmother and his sisters. Now, Catholics, nice Irish Catholic, bless us, O Lord, in these thy gifts which we are about to receive from thy bounty through Christ our Lord. Amen. We said that at every single meal. We would sit around the table, and that was the first thing. These are some of my rules that I grew up with. I couldn't wear a white t-shirt to the table. Okay? Why? Beats me. Because that's what happened. Okay. I grew up in this family, and Dad had no clue how to be a father, but then he's Irish, and he's my heritage. So he and my mother both graduate from the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science in 1953, and they get married. Now, in 1953, there were not many women registered pharmacists in Pennsylvania. Then takes a job with Eli Lilly, moves out to Indianapolis. Now, my mother is a Margraf. That's German. She has her baggage that she's bringing to the table. While he's out there, my older brother is born. My older brother Tom had, I can't remember the name of it, but he had a growth on his face. It was the same as that was on my aunt. So it's family, familial. God bless you. He had 7 operations before I was born. I was born 22 months later. You can see the pattern. Okay? And I came out a healthy, bouncing baby boy, born on a Thursday. And there we have it. My brother, Jerry, is conceived, and he is born 6 weeks premature, lived for 8 hours. Okay, 1958, they did not have the prenatal stuff that we have now. So he lived for 8 hours, and the big story is that he was born at St. Francis, that the nuns, the nurse nuns, baptized him. He's going to meet us in heaven. Okay, so now we have significant trauma yet again in the family. Tommy's cripple. I don't want to call him cripple, but he's got issues. I'm healthy. Jerry dies. My grandparents, my father shared this with me, later on, my grandparents are sending messages to my mother because, you see, she wasn't employed. They had paid for a college education. She did very well, and this guy took her to Indiana and can't seem to keep her unpregnant. And so the message coming from that side of the family to my mother is, you know, don't you know how this works kind of stuff? It's a little more explicit with my father. He then decides they move to Pittsburgh. My younger brother is born. We're there 1 year. Rick is born, 1960. And for whatever reason, my mother decides that, you know, she's overweight. She's a pharmacist, so bing, bang, boom, amphetamines move into the system. Amphetamines, smoking, alcohol. Crazy. So I have this non-existent mother. Okay? We moved to a little town in Pennsylvania called Nazareth. Nazareth, Pennsylvania, just down the road from Bethlehem, over the hill from Emmaus. Those Moravians were smart people. And he buys a pharmacy. And this is all a little bit of background. He buys a pharmacy, and they become the town pharmacist. Now, it's a small town of about 5,000 people. So when you're the town pharmacist, what do you know? Everything. Okay? Because he would say this a lot. In the good times, people need their medication. In the bad times, they need more medication. So he then went to work. My father, when I was growing up, worked from 7:30 in the morning till 9:30 at night, 6 days a week, and on Sundays we'd go to 7 o'clock Mass, like little ducks, and then we'd go out and have breakfast, and then we'd all go over to the store, and we would clean up from the week so that he could do it all over again. He did that until I was a senior in high school. Okay? He did that. That's a lot of hours. Very successful. Very not absent or not home. So we were dealing with my mother. And so my mother, we'd sit at the table and whatever went on during the day was always handled with, wait till your father gets home. I don't mean to point at you, but wait till your father gets home. Okay, wait till my father gets home. He would come through the door at around 9:30 after closing the store. And inside the refrigerator was a decanter, and he had his Manhattans. Yeah, they were already mixed. So we'd be upstairs, up the wooden hill, it was called, 13 steps to the attic. That's where my brothers and I lived. He'd come home, and you'd hear that through the floor stuff, you know, the crescendo, mom and dad, and, oh, Tom, Jean, blah, blah, blah. And then it would be, okay, Jean, I'll take care of this. The door to the bottom of the steps would open. There's 13 steps up. And then somebody's ass got whooped. Typically, it was mine. I'm the scapegoat in that organization. So that typically meant that I was thrown down the steps, beaten in front of my mother, and then with an ending of, okay, Jean, there, I took care of it, and then chased and kicked up the steps. And you could not make a noise because there's the other classic line. If you make some sound, if you cry, you're going to get something to cry about. Okay? And that would go on pretty much two or three times a week. And then other times of those two or three times a week, it wouldn't go on. So I would lay there at the top of the steps, listen to it downstairs, and then wait. And then wait. And then wait. And then wait. And he wouldn't come up. Or, conversely, I'd fall asleep. And there's nothing worse than getting jerked out of your sleep and thrown down the steps. So this is the goings-on inside the house. Okay? The goings-on. 1964, the princess was born. That's my sister. And life changed again significantly because now she was born. MJ was here. And that again changed how we were treated, my brothers and I. All this time, we'd sit at the dinner table. I sat there, Tom sat there. Well, Rick was in the middle for a while. Mom sat at that head, Dad sat at this head, then Tommy moved over here, and that was where we sat. And it was such a way that, there were rules, you know, don't touch your plate until after we say grace. Why? I don't know, I'm going to hell. Who knows? Take what you want, pass it to the right. It always went to the right. And then you had to clean the plate. Regardless of what was on it, you had to clean the plate. And that's how I grew up, around my kitchen table. There's a couple of other significant events that, when I have the opportunity to tell my story. But one important one was 24 January 1971. I don't know about the rest of you ACAs, but I remember important dates, like when I was beaten and I ran out of the house. Okay, I hit my brother with a shoe. I'll date myself. Click, click, click. What am I doing? I'm changing the channel on a television. Huh? The other crescendo, the other mantra was downstairs or outside. You're not welcome here. Go downstairs or get outside. And when do you want me back? When the sun goes down. Okay? Whatever. Just don't be here. So I'm downstairs, my brother, and I'm watching television. And he changes the channel. I smack him with a shoe. We start wrestling. And the old man goes off. Okay? Goes off. Chasing me around the house. Threw a knife. Grace of God, the butt hit me in the back. He's beating me with a stick. I see the door. I go out the door. It's 24th of January, 1971. Before global warming, we had snow on the ground in Pennsylvania. Okay, I had no shoes on. I had my pants, and I had a t-shirt. I'm bleeding out of every hole in my head. He hit me with a broom, and it had taken the side of my face off. You know, it had burned my face. I'm black and blue from my waist up. I know that because went down the alley, and that's a significant 2-minute time frame in my entire life. Went down that alley. At the end of the alley, a police officer drove by. Car backs up. What happened to you? What's the first words out of my mouth? I made him do that. I made him do this. Okay, police officer takes me over to the police station. Police station, they don't know what to do with me. Put me in the ambulance, take me down to the hospital. They don't know what to do with me. This is 1971. It wasn't illegal to beat your kids in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania until 1976. You could not beat your dog, but you could beat your kids in 1971. I go. Sorry. I'm in the hospital, but they couldn't treat me because they needed some kind of parental stuff. So it's now 4 o'clock in the morning when they finally, dad or whoever, finally shows up. And I sat there on that gurney and I watched that clock go around and around and around, and it took forever. I come home. Well, dad, they come in, they treat me, they patch me up. Nothing was really broken. So we go home. 6:30 is another one of those times. 6:30 is time to get up because you have to get dressed and walk to school. You got to walk, go to school. Three little duckies, white shirt, blue tie, blue pants, black socks, black shoes. And we're getting dressed. Dad calls Tom and me into the living room, and this is a classic. You're my son. I will feed you. I will put a roof over your head and clothes on your back. And that's it. And from that moment on, he never touched me again. Ever. Till I was in the Navy and had gotten the hell out of Dodge. Never. Didn't acknowledge me. So I go from that whole negative attention thing to nothing. And that is my definition of hell. Okay, apathy. I walk to school. I go in. I'm in eighth grade. I sit there in class. I can't take it after about an hour and a half. I walk out of the class. The teacher, what's going on? Now I am still pretty much black and blue, with the side of my face torn off. And I tell her the same thing. I made him do this. She takes me to the principal. I made him do this. Principal takes me over to the pastor. I made him do this. Pastor sends me back to the class, and I walk home that evening to sit at the dinner table as if nothing ever happened. It was never talked about again, period. I've had some opportunity to talk to my brothers about that evening and my sister. And my older brother, his recollection of that night is he was hiding. He said, Dad was on a warpath, I was hiding. Rick, my younger brother, he's one of Dad's enablers over the years. because they would drink and smoke dope together. He said, well, you know, I had that conversation with Dad once, and I seemed to him to remember that there was the police came to the house, and the police said something along the lines, now this is anecdotal from my brother, from my dad, said, you know, Tom, if you're going to beat your kids, don't let them get out. Okay? Because you're the pharmacist. You're the town guy. Don't let them get out. And my sister, you know, she doesn't remember anything, you know, because she's the one that had to witness all of it, you know, when we would stand and take our turns being, beaten, whipped with coffee pot cords. My grandfather, the German, had done his daughter a favor, and he was worked at a paper place, Curtis Printing. And he had brought, and it hung at the bottom of the steps, so when you came down, it was right there where you hung your coats. The belt, it was called. It was 2 inches wide, it was 6 foot long. It was a quarter inch thick. It was leather, hung at the bottom of this. And that, I have had, that was one of their favorites, my father's, because it would leave welts. I'm looking for something black like that. Like your coat. I would get shipped down to my aunt's house near Philadelphia in the summer, and I never figured out why I would go down there for the summer, each summer. Well, you can't have kids in town going to the pool with welts on their back, and you're the town pharmacist. So all of this stuff comes together and around the table. The rules that we learned around the table, that I learned around the table. And I've been approached on by several people this weekend already about, yeah, my table. This is what happened. My ACA group back home, they were ready, the sacrificial altar. Or something. You know, there's two sisters, Anne and Mary, the sacrificial altar, you know? And it would happen that the way the table was situated was always in reach of a backhand. And the backhand was meant to emphasize whatever the lesson was for that moment. Most of the time, that lesson was, what's wrong with you? And then it is punctuated with a slap in the face. Okay? Or, what were you thinking? I don't know. What's wrong with me? Well, if I had the ability, I would have said, stop slapping me in the face and I'll tell you. I'll be able to figure it out. But none of that went outside the house. None of it went outside the house. So we had this ritual. At the dinner table, we sat at that table as if nothing ever happened. Sundays, 2 o'clock, get the silver out of the china closet, sit in the big room, and eat everything on the plate, and then, may I be excused? No. Why? Don't ask why. Well, you know, later on I got a little bigger. Why? Because I want to look at you. Right? Well, he's catching up. Okay. But may I be excused? No, sit there, you know. So the idea came that I'm not the only one that probably has stories like this, war stories, horror stories, whatever you want to call them, around the rituals that we all learned at the dinner table. Now remember that little exercise we did? That was nonverbal. Where'd we all end up? You all ended up doing the same thing without saying a word. That's the power of what went on at the dinner table. You didn't have to be told. You knew when they sat down that there was an ass whooping coming. You just knew it. And I can talk to you all about all the ways that, you know, I disassociated and I did this and I did that and all of that stuff that I've been able to get a little bit of insight in. But my thrust, my object here is for you as groups or as a large group to discuss how things are different today. I'll jump forward in a little bit. Okay? I'm now in high school. Now, I'm an Eagle Scout, National Honor Society, A student, scholar athlete, college, scholarship. All of that trying to get my dad to say, good job. Okay? All of that trying to get my dad to say, good job. Now remember, I told you back in 1971, nothing is nothing. Nothing is nothing. Okay? I come home, and then I find my first wife, who comes from her side of dysfunction, and we fit like gloves. Right? We fit like gloves. The last time that I wanted to be an auto mechanic is what I wanted to, but then I went to Moravian College as a pre-med, because you can't, no son of mine's going to be an auto mechanic. So I went to pre-med for a semester, and I was drunk every day. At 13, after the part of my story that it gets real, at 13, after in that January, that March, I found alcohol, the power of alcohol, because I found a bag of Matus on the way to school, put it in my book bag, and suddenly, you know, I wasn't always this handsome. Okay? In grade school, my nickname was Fat Fingers. Okay? In high school, my nickname was Fat Man. Okay? Now I'm just fat. Okay? That's just the way it was. But there I was, having gotten nothing at home, I got a bottle of Matus, and suddenly the cool guys wanted me to come down to the locker room. And I went, I was in. And I said, I know how to do this. Because there was more alcohol, and I mean, we lived right down the street from the state store. 3 months later, I found marijuana. And I can tell you, marijuana worked, dope worked for me once, the first time. I can tell you the color, smell, taste. Euphoric recall, they call it. And I walked into my aunt's house, and for the very first time, you know, I'm not one of those guys, I didn't grow up pouring out alcohol and wishing they would drink. I was clueless because it was my fault. That was the problem. It had nothing to do with them. I walked into that house stoned, and I saw it. They were all drunk. They were all drunk. I'm losing it. They were all drunk. And I went, so that's what this is all about. And then for the next 17 years, I drank and I drugged. Okay. Okay. So for the next 17 years, I drank and I drugged. Now, in that 17 years, I joined the Navy. I got the hell out of Dodge. I made rank. I got married. I have 5 children, 5 lovely children. Okay, that's my granddaughter on the picture out there. I have 5 granddaughters. All of that occurring, you know, because I just replaced my dad with the Navy. And then the Navy, you know what happens in the Navy if you do a good job? You get promoted. So holy cow, I made 8 E8 in 14 years. Boom, it was great. I also got sober in the Navy. Okay, that's another different story. But the way that I drank, I drank to get drunk. I drank for effect. When I tell my drinking, when I tell that story, I am what is known in my world as a pig drinker. I drink to fall down. It was for effect. Okay? There was no teetotaling with me. And I drugged and did the same thing. You know? I'm the guy that's sitting in the corner washing down some Quaaludes with Jack Daniels. And that's how I got along. Because that's what I was trying to put away. It'll never happen to me. Okay? That's Claudia's book. I remember saying those words, I will not be like my dad. And I raised my kids with every ounce that I had as best that I could to not do what my parents did. And we'd started slowly at the dinner table. We would sit at the table and we would have dinner. We would eat as a family every night, tradition. But they could get down if they, and they didn't have to empty the plates. I mean, little things, okay? Little things. My oldest is a, my oldest Jennifer. She is a civil and environmental engineer with her PE, and she also is the mother of my two granddaughters. My second son, or my first son, Matthew, graduated from the Naval Academy and then went on to Lehigh to get his second degree, and he is the father of my son, my grandson, Quinn Liam. Okay. Melissa, my second daughter, she is a first grade teacher. She's the mother of my two other grandsons, Eli and Owen. Timothy, my fourth, he went to college one day. One day. Was not acceptable in my house. One day, came home and said, this is not for me. Save your money. Okay, what would you like to be? I want to be an auto mechanic. Now, my son, Timothy, is the number four pit crew mechanic for Porsche North American Motorsports in the GTLM series. Okay, he just finished up down at Daytona 24, and they're getting ready to race at Sebring. Okay? Who knew? My youngest son, he's the ginormous one. He is 6 foot five, 280 pounds. He's getting married here in July to a 6 foot four, beautiful blonde, okay, who when I first met her had 4-inch stiletto heels on. I'll let you do the height difference. And he teaches high school history and coaches wrestling and football. So things can change. Now, that's not to say we're without issues, but we eat dinner. We can have dinner at the table. So you can change. We all can change. I can change. If I can change, you know, pretty much anybody can change. So I've got, we started 10 minutes late, so I get 10 more minutes. I have 20 minutes, so for the next, say, 15 minutes, let's kind of get in little groups and talk about what are some of the things that you can do today at the table with whoever it is that you're eating dinner with. Even if it's yourself, okay? Because if you're eating by yourself, do you set the table? Everybody deserves to get into a made bed and to eat at a plate at the table. We all deserve it, right? I deserve it. I set the table. My wife does the cooking. I do all the dishes. We're made in heaven. Okay? So little things that will, over time, change the way that that is perceived. I love sitting at the table with my grandkids because it's just, there's five of them, and their oldest is six.
And so there's just lots of energy and love, and they, you know, there's milk on the floor and there's stuff on the wall, and there's nobody sitting quiet waiting to get slapped. How cool is that? That's my kids teaching, trying to break this thing. And then, I think this is still on. I get this. I get this text from my oldest son. My oldest son is bipolar. I told you he graduated from the Naval Academy. 21 days before he graduated from the Naval Academy, he woke up in the psychiatric ward at Walter Reed Hospital with a diagnosis of bipolar, which then went into another whole 6 years of hell, which is a different part of the story. But today, he's medicine compliant, and he is the national manager of getting pieces, parts to the places they need to go. So this paragraph strikes home with me. I, too, have had anger against Nicole for the dreams that I have, quote, sacrificed for stability and a semblance of peace. My adventurous spirit is replaced by absolute loyalty and meekness to support her loss while abandoning my own. I wonder if we share this anger, this loss of self, replaced by familial dedication, incessant hard work, and subdued personal dreams. Perhaps Pop-Pop K, my dad, had the same anger towards Nana, my mom, and passed that same wound on to you. Perhaps his anger manifested in abuse and neglect of his children and vanished into alcoholism and even goes back to my great-grandfather. You are allowing me to break the cycle of victimhood and anger that has endured for generations in our family, a journey you started with your sobriety. I appreciate the opportunity for clarity and your struggle to endure despite your wounds, offering your children a chance at something better. I love to talk to you more, Dad. Love you, Dad, Matt. Perhaps partial redemption for the loss of your dreams can be found in knowing that I acknowledge your suffering and remain and your loneliness to remain strong for me. Thank that sacrifice is noted and felt sincerely as gratitude I have for your healing path. Love you, Matt. We can change, and it starts right here. So let's take 15 minutes and just talk about what we can change. One little thing needs to change, and the butterfly effect will take over. Thank you.
Thank you.